with Jay Cuban.
Welcome back to Fashion Talks. Today I have a really special guest. He's the he represents the California's 21st district. He's a state senator, been elected in 2016 with Senator Scott Wilk. And so thank you very much for being on here.
Thanks for having me, Jacob.
Before I get into like kind of COVID and talking about some of that stuff, I really wanted to ask you kind of on a personal level, you know, what made you run and then how did you get involved in that? I have a kind of a young audience for the most part. In college and some of them in political science. And I just kind of want to hear your background on that.
Sure. Well, unlike a lot of young people, I kind of knew what I wanted to do pretty early on in life. So I know no one reads newspapers nowadays, but I started reading the newspaper at 12. In fact, back then we got two newspapers. We got a morning newspaper and an afternoon. I read them both. And then when I was 13 years old, I had made All-Stars in baseball, but the All-Star season was the same time as our planned family vacation. And of course, I wanted to stay home and play ball. And my parents are not going to let a 13-year-old kid stay home for, you know, 2 weeks. So I had to go on the family vacation. And most of it was in Oregon, but we spent a couple days in Sacramento. So, you know, Sutter's Fort, you know, all that type stuff. And I just remembered with my family being on a tour of the Capitol and then sitting in the balcony of the state Senate saying, that's what I want to do. So at 13 years old, that's what I wanted to do. I got there at 57.
Nice. Well, that's pretty awesome. I had a chance to visit Sacramento when I was, I think, 14. And it was pretty neat walking around there. You get to see a lot of history, buildings and all that. And
so that's what I want to do. But obviously I've done, you know, different things in my life. I've been political staffers to a number of elected officials. And also my wife and I've owned three different businesses over the years. But in terms of getting elected, I think the reason I got elected for the first time, which was in the state assembly in 2012, is that I was active in my community. So, you know, we have term limits, so you kind of know when people are leaving office. And right. My assemblyman at the time was Cameron Smythe. He was termed out. And a lot of people in the Santa Clarita Valley kind of assumed I was going to do it. So I threw my hat in the ring. And then a couple of months later, my congressman's wife decided she wanted to run. And so if I had only been involved in politics, I would, there's no way I would have ever won because all the political donors, you know, they hid. And so, right. But, you know, I was active in my church. My wife and I were active in the schools and in youth sports. And, you know, I was on, you know, involved in the Chamber of Commerce. I was, you know, on the foundation for the hospital and for the community college. So if you look at my donor list, it doesn't look like any other office holder's donor list. Because it's people that I knew and worked with in the community. If I had just been a political hack, the minute she got in the race, I would have been done because I wouldn't have been able to raise the money to compete. Right. So I think you're a better legislator too if you actually know people, you know what their challenges and concerns are.
Yeah, you build all those connections kind of early on and set your foundations. Yeah. Yep. If you don't mind me asking, what were some of the businesses you owned?
So owned a... first one was a vending company, which wasn't good because my wife Vanessa got pregnant while we owned that and gained 25 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah, not good. and then a PR company in the 90s. And then up until the time I got elected to the state assembly, I had a public affairs firm. So most of it was development related. So helping developers get their projects approved. There was some other stuff too, but my primary income would say was developer driven.
Gotcha. So I just read today on your website, and I was kind of excited to see it, that you're working on a bipartisan deal trying to deem restaurants as essential businesses in California, correct?
Yes.
And
yeah. So, go ahead.
Talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of frustrated with the whole COVID situation to begin with. So on the 16th of March, and I remember it vividly because it was my birthday. we get called in to caucus, And we were briefed by Dr. Galley, who's Secretary of HHS, and Dr. Angel, who was at that time head of public health, for a private briefing. And, you know, we knew COVID was coming at that point, right? Because it was mid-March. I already had a friend who passed away from COVID on the 6th of March, so I was aware of it. But, you know, during our briefing, they said highly infectious, and we could expect 25 million Californians to be infected, and highly deadly. And out of those 25 million, 3 million Californians were going to die.
Wow.
So that was the information we were given. So then they come to the floor that afternoon and want to give him emergency powers. And, you know, obviously he, you know, he's the administrator, you know,
and
he's the
chief
executive.
Governor Newsom?
Yeah. I'm talking about Governor Newsom. So you've got, you know, you got to give him some flexibility, but so we voted to get to grant him emergency powers. Frankly, I was a little reluctant to do that. Not because he's left and I'm center right, but to me, so far, he's not struck me as a serious person, nor somebody interested in governing. You know, I served, my first few years with Governor Brown, and whether you agree with him or disagree with him, he was certainly engaged in the process, and he loved to govern. This guy's like completely detached from the legislature. He, you know, he's like not trusted in by either party. So anyway, so, you know, we voted, you know, to give him the emergency powers. And so here's my position on COVID. We need to follow sound science backed by, now I want publicly released data, because he won't release the data. And then I prefer local decision makers to make those calls, not you know, one size fits all out of Sacramento. So like the case of LA County, right? It's 4,006 square miles, so it's massive.
Yeah.
And I represent the Santa Clarita and Antelope Valley portion of my LA part of my district is, you know, that area. And it's suburban or rural, right? So, you know, it's not an urban core. We're not bunched up. If you're in the Antelope Valley, you got a ton of wind all the time. So it should be, and I don't think that, I think the data looks probably much differently. Don't know, because we was never able to grab it. But anyway, so that's been kind of my position. And so since then, I've been kind of pushing back on this stuff. In fact, Dr. Galley, I don't know, 10 days ago, admitted they have no data in terms of, you know, the dangers of outdoor dining. And here's the thing about the COVID, right? My goal is that we manage it, not let us control it. I mean, obviously it can be deadly, you know, if you're older, if you got some underlying health issues, but for a great many people, it's not. So, you know, let's manage it properly, you know, social distancing, masks, you know, all those type things, but eating outside, I'm sorry. I just don't see it.
Right.
I don't see it.
That's something I also wanted to kind of ask, like when you guys are discussing kind of regulations and rules and like how you guys should handle it, what goes into that? Is there a lot of like scientific data? Cause it.
That's my whole problem. We gave him emergency powers. So he is doing this all unilaterally with his public health team. Dr. Angel, he's already fired because she had inaccurate data. They won't release the data. Many legislators have put in requests asking for the data to support, you know, the policy actions that he's taken, and he's not done it. So, you know, we do get private briefings, and I will tell you, they're getting pretty contentious. So, you know, if you're on the, so, you know, I'm a registered Republican, so I'm in the minority party. There's nothing anybody can do to me. But if you're in the majority party, there's, you know, they can take away committee chairmanship. They can move your offices. There's a lot of stuff that they can do. So typically, and so typically you stay in line, but I'm thinking that's not going to happen because we're on these calls and, you know, and I got my Democratic colleagues asking us pretty, you know, pointed questions and really pushing back.
So I
would like to see us probably modify that emergency power, and so we rein him in a little bit. So we'll see what happens. We get back. We go back January 4th.
And so that's the earliest that you could even kind of talk
right.
about doing
yeah.
something like that.
Yes.
Gotcha. And so is that? So restaurants are trying to get deemed essential. As far as like churches and gyms right now, is that kind of how's that looking?
Right. Well, it depends where you're at. So mm-hmm. like in LA County, we're shut down. So you can do outside services, but not inside services right now.
And
gyms, I don't belong to a gym, so I'm not sure. Well, you know, my son's gym, it's outside, but it's in LA County. So I don't even know how that's open. I don't think it's supposed to be open. So I'm not going to say the name of it because I think people should be able to work out.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the toll. That's the toll that we're not quantifying is in terms of, you know, depression, suicide, alcoholism, mm-hmm. drugs, child abuse, domestic violence, you know, all those things I think are just raging. And you know, we're allowing it to, we just gotta have a better balance in mind.
Well, yeah, we're taking away people's outlets right now. Yep. So it's like, you're not giving them many options. What about, like, so I want to kind of talk to you about schools and sports. Sure. So when I was in high school, like a lot of it was just athletics. And for me anyway, that was a big part of it. And I went and played college football and it was like, and you had to have film to be able to recruit. And sure. I know athletics isn't, you know, the forefront of people's thoughts right now, but I just wanted, like, so when do you think schools and like, what's the data saying on, you know, like COVID cases.
So, well, yeah, you know what? I don't think there is a lot of data, but so here's the thing that I know. So I swore in two new school board members at one of my local elementary school districts last night. And I sat there to listen to, I was sitting right here. It was on Zoom, but hearing from teachers and from parents and, you know, my sense is, that schools are not going to open up until they not only do the schools have to be safe, but people have to feel safe. Mm-hmm. So I really don't think you're going to see schools and or athletics get back to normal until the fall of next year is my guess.
Wow.
To me, again, that should be based upon, I think local decision makers based again upon the science and the data should be making those decisions, not me. You just asked me what my best guess is, and I'm telling you, I don't right. think till fall of next year. And I just saw the Pac-10 championship game this Friday night that I guess Washington's got a lot of COVID cases, so they're swapping out and having the Ducks play the Trojans. So yeah, if you're trying to get from a high school into a good college on a scholarship, or you know your senior year and college and want to go pro, I mean, man, it's really got to be a challenge.
Well, colleges have their work cut out for them trying to recruit some kids anyway.
Yeah.
But so looking across, I mean, and I know, you know, we're in California, but looking across the country, do you guys look at other states and what they're doing and trying to, you know, see if that would work here, or how do you guys?
Well, again, I mean, we gave the emergency powers to the governor, so I don't know what he is or is not doing. But I was at an event, man, maybe 7 weeks ago, and I went. So I have a wife with an autoimmune disease, and my 94-year-old mother-in-law lives with us. So I've always been very careful because they're both at risk. And so I'm really careful. I got invited to an event and I was told, oh, we're going to have social distancing, yada, yada. So I went and they didn't, which is problematic. But I was at a table at a dinner and the woman sitting next to me had just come back from Florida where everything was open. Everything, I mean, bars, restaurants, you know, everything open. And my family is all immigrated from Southern California to Knoxville, Tennessee. Everything's open there as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I go to school out in Florida right now and it's a whole different world. I came back for break and it's like everything just, you know, shut down. You can't go to gyms, restaurants aren't open, which I get to an extent. But
well, I think right now indoor eating, because we got a surge going on, I do get that. But yeah, I mean, if you compare, I mean, we're doing horrible compared to other states, and other states are a lot more open.
Right.
And, you know, we ask those questions and, you know, we just don't get answers.
So when you say like emergency, he can do anything he wants right now, or how's that?
Yeah, it was really broadly written. So, you know, normally we get input on stuff like that. So March 16th was a Monday and I actually stayed up in the Sacramento area for the weekend because it was actually my birthday was on that day on the 16th, and I was supposed to have 120 constituents come up from the district where for the last 14 years the local legislator from Santa Cruz has put on like a day and a half conference for people. That got canceled the week before, but my wife and I had already made plans to go wine tasting and stuff, and so like Sunday afternoon we're at a winery. And where I get a text from the governor's office saying, "Yeah, we're shutting down bars and wineries."
Just get a text.
And I'm like, "What do you drink up?" And then we had dinner reservations that night at a pretty exclusive restaurant, not French Laundry, but a really good restaurant. And they like texted me like three times over the weekend, "Are you coming? Are you coming?" I'm like, "Yeah, of course I'm coming." So we stayed Sunday night. So I'm driving. It was only an hour drive back to Sacramento. So we're driving back when I got the call. Hey. We got an emergency order. We got a resolution in to give them, emergency powers. And I don't know how many people were consulted on the Democratic side of the aisle. No one on the Republican side of the aisle was at all. And typically we are. I mean, D.C. works a little differently than Sacramento. I mean, like they don't talk to each other in D.C. Mm-hmm. We talk to one another. You know, like in the Senate, there's only 40 of us. It's small. And that chamber's small. And so you're like, if you're in a fight with somebody, it's kind of really hard to duck them. And so we work pretty collaborative. And then the Senate, we tend to be older. And, you know, this is probably the capstone of our career. So there's just not the political pressures like you have in the Assembly, or maybe local office. So we normally collaborate together pretty well. Now, we don't agree all the time.
Yeah.
But we at least, you know, have dialogue on stuff. But this was really completely devoid of dialogue or input at all. It was just a power play by the governor allowed by Senate leadership.
And then, so is it up until a certain point or is it just
No. It's open-ended. So Melissa Melendez down from Western Riverside County put in a resolution last year. It was Senate Resolution 93, I believe. And it just sat in the Rules Committee and they would not move it. And so there's a process called wharfing, which without reference to file, when you can bring something out of any committee and directly to the floor. And so every day when we had legislative session, we would try to wharf it to the floor. And of course, they would table it, yeah. Even though there's a lot of Democratic members that would love to remove those powers as well. So I'm hoping there's enough frustration now that maybe we do a new resolution and we put in some safeguards so we have more input. Again, you know, we're all home, so it's kind of hard to have those conversations, but we'll see when we get back.
You said earlier that it can kind of, if you're a Democrat and you kind of go against, you know, your fellow Democrat or vice versa, but since, you know, that they're the majority party, and it can kind of hurt your career. And so is that something that people are definitely kind of worried about? Or?
Of course. So I'll give you an example. I'm not going to name names or what, but so I just got reelected in November. And again, I'm a Republican. My seat is +8 Democrat. So it should be represented by a Democrat based upon voter registration. Okay. Yesterday the committee assignments came out and a friend of mine on the Democratic side of the aisle was no longer chair of a particular committee, which is a powerful committee. And he's a really good chair. In fact, out of all the senators, he's the person I respect the most. So I called him and go, are you being punished for something? And he said, yeah. So he contributed to all the, what's called targeted seats. So if it's a competitive seat, it's called a targeted seat.
Okay.
So he contributed to every race, but mine. He refused to contribute to my opponent. And so because of that, he's being punished.
Wow.
So even though he was the largest giver, to the leadership pack, but he did not contribute 4,700 against me. So he lost his chairmanship.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it is. How much worse? To be honest, that's not right.
It's not. How much worse is like in D.C.?
D.C. is brutal. Yeah, yeah. I mean, so like we're the biggest legislature, you know, in state legislature, yeah. Obviously in the country. But I worked in D.C. early in my career. So I would say if D.C.'s pros, we're probably only double A ball. You know, most of these other states are not, you know, they're not even, they might be single A or worse.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'd say we're double. We're not even triple A.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
The games you got to play just to kind of.
Part of it. Yeah. Part of it.
Yeah. So also I was reading, it says Economic Development Department. You've been doing a lot. There's a lot of articles on your website about it. I just kind of want to ask you a little bit, because you've been kind of getting on Newsom about what he's not doing or stuff he is doing about it. I just kind of want to ask you, so what is it? What does it kind of entail? And then what is...
Are you talking about the unemployment, the Employment Development Department? Yeah, EDD.
Sorry,
yeah.
I messed up. EDD.
No, I know. I know it. No, I knew what you're talking about.
I had it written down.
Well, so, you know, here's the thing. So I got to tell you, part of it is not Newsom's fault.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I used to sit in the Assembly, and then my first 2 years on the Senate on the Budget Committee sub 4, which is state administration. And so they had a lot of oversight over computer systems in these various state agencies and boards. And they're like all messed up. And they need to be fixed. And these bureaucrats, I mean, they spend tens of millions of dollars, and it's just like epic failure after epic failure. And so he inherited that. So that I'm not going to fault him with too much. Mm-hmm. In fact, I didn't even know this until this happened. So the language they use, so the operating system they use for EDD is COBOL. Okay. I graduated from college a long time ago. We used COBOL when I was in college. I mean, it's like, it doesn't even exist anymore. So it's ridiculous. But so I don't fault him for that, but we need to fix it. But I do fault him. He knows he's going to shut down the economy. So he should have been at that point redeploying state employees over to handle the tsunami of requests that were going to, you know, come in. I mean, when we started, it was only open 4 hours a day to call in. And then it's just been a debacle. And then they've been just, you saw where they've been, you know, mailing out to state prisoners, and there's been all kinds of fraud. So
yeah.
I had a businessman in my district. This is like months ago now. So he called and goes, "Hey Scott, I got 50 EDD envelopes here from people who I don't even know who they are." So I say, "Hey, well, that's fine. We'll pick it up. We'll scan it. We'll let EDD know so we can, you know, take care of that." So we go do that. Then 2 weeks later, he gets the same 50. So then we go pick it up again. We call over, "Oh no, we're going to get it fixed." And then 2 weeks later, he gets the same 50. So that's been 6 weeks not fixed. So then I take it. I take a photo of all these, and I text it to the governor, and the governor's like, "Well, you know, let me see." You know, he's like all indignant. "Well, I'll handle this for you. Don't worry about it." And then so I talked to my staff in the Lancaster office. Unbeknownst to me, they've been collecting them from all kinds of people. We had like 1,200.
Oh my goodness!
Illegal envelopes there. So we put them all in a box, and then we shipped them up north. We couldn't put it into the Capitol because of COVID, but we shipped it offsite. And then I had somebody walk it into the governor's office, and I have yet to hear back from the governor on it.
So how does that even happen? So it's just this system's just so out of date, and it's
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So these vaccines, have you heard anything about them? Because there should be. So what is it? I know a lot of people, you know, just on through social media, they're like, "Oh, I don't want to take it," or, you know, stuff like that. What would you have to say about that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I believe in free will.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you should do whatever you want. So basically, I anticipate there's going to be 4 different vaccines that are going to ultimately be approved. You're going to have Pfizer, which has already been approved, Moderna, mm-hmm. which should be up next. And then you're going to have AstraZeneca, and you're going to have Johnson & Johnson. And so should be plenty available eventually. If you are older, or if you have underlying health issues, from what I've been told from the experts, is you should take the Pfizer or the Moderna, because that one's a new technology. So most vaccines where they inject you with dead virus cells, right?
Yeah.
So it'd be dead coronavirus cells, where the Pfizer and the Moderna is this new technology which actually helps your body defeat the virus. So if you have those kind of issues, you should do that. The Governor Newsom's got a task force. They've not come out with their full plan yet in terms of how they're going to unveil it. I believe we are getting the first shipment. It came in yesterday. It's coming in today. And so, I mean, it's going to be, you know, healthcare workers and first responders and elderly first. If you're a regular person, your timeline is probably going to be mid to late April and May. They all, I believe, require two injections. So you have to do the first one, and then you take the second one 3 weeks later. You typically have no, if you have any side effects at all, it's not on the first booster, but on the second. But, you know, the effective rate is quite high. You know, it's, you know, the Moderna and the Pfizer is like at 95%. And I think AstraZeneca is over 90%. You know, the whooping cough, which we require as a state, its success rate is only 60%.
Wow.
So to be up in the 90s is really a phenomenal job. And I got briefed by AstraZeneca, I don't know, maybe 5 weeks ago. And one of the reasons why they were able to do it so fast is that typically the pharmaceutical company would just do all this on their own. And then when we feel like that it's done, then they go through the FDA process, right? So, but what they did for this to expedite it is they embedded from the very beginning FDA officials to conduct oversight. So government regulators were there the entire time, you know, giving input, looking at the data. And so I feel pretty confident that it's going to be safe. Again, you know, vaccines has been a big issue in the Capitol. And, you know, there are some people based upon genetics that have suffered, you know, vaccine damage. I mean, it's just a fact. You know, the federal government has paid out about $4 billion since 1986 to people that have suffered vaccine damage. So it happens, but I mean, it's low single digits. Yeah. And, you know, the fact of the matter is we need to get to herd immunity for us to be safe. And that's typically, you know, low 90s at a minimum. So people are going to have to get it, or they're going to, you know, in terms of, you know, getting in and have antibodies or get the vaccination.
Right. And
so I got questions for you.
Yeah.
So I was told the other day that legislators were going to be able to get it in February. Now, do I get it in February or do I wait and get it in May when like most people are going to get it? I figure I'm going to get grief either way, right?
I don't know. Hey, you can get it in February and you let me know how it goes. And I'll get it in
there
May.
You go.
How's that sound?
Yeah. No, I always said that, you know, Trump should get it first. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see how he handles it. But he shook off COVID pretty quick. So,
you know, it's really weird, right? Like I've known three people who've died from it. One of my really close friends, and then I like had a family member who got it, and he's like 350 pounds and he's over 60 and he's got diabetes and he uses a sleep apnea machine. And I'm going, oh my gosh, he's going to be dead. he literally had it like 4 days. He literally had it 4 days.
Yeah.
He didn't have his taste for like 2 weeks, but he had like, it was the bizarrest thing.
It's so weird. Cause I had it. And I mean, but then again, I'm probably very low, you know,
right.
Low chance of it being bad because 20-year-old and I worked out and all that. And then it took me 2 days. And I kind of, you know, maybe like the third day I was still a little bit, but it wasn't bad.
Did you figure out where you caught it?
Well, so I was at school and I don't know how I got it. Cause like it's in Florida, we are in camp in classes. We have some in-person classes.
Yeah.
Like it was like half online, half in-person. And, so then I had to go quarantine on campus. They had like a separate dorm building set up for people who tested positive. And they did a good job overall. Like not too many people contracted it or anything. But yeah, I got it. It was weird. But 2-3 days I was done, and then I just had to sit there, you know, for the week and a half or week, whatever it was. But it wasn't too bad. But I also know some people who had it, and it was like, you know, knocked them off their feet, and it was pretty bad.
Yeah. Young people?
No, not young people, but it was just older people.
Yeah.
And so that's another thing where it's like, it almost creates an argument for, you know, in-person school or letting, you know, like, I guess an argument some people had that I've heard that kind of makes sense to me. But then again, I'm not as caught up with you as far as the data and talking to people, but you know, some people for sure should be quarantining, and, you know, taking all those necessary precautions, but maybe another age group, you know, when the whole lockdown was like, they should be allowed to work. They should be allowed to go about their lives, to an extent, but it's just, I guess there's a balance that you got to find.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you. There is a balance, but elementary school kids should be in school.
Yeah.
There's minuscule risk. And in fact, there's risk in life.
There is,
you know,
yeah,
there's risk in life, and you can't take all the risk. You can't take all the risk out of life, or you're not even going to be able to live. So yeah, I'm really frustrated with that, because I really believe that elementary school kids should be in school, but again, based upon the data.
Yeah. Plus online learning is not,
it's horrible
for me. It's not optimal. I can't stand online classes.
Yeah.
You know, you just got to force yourself to watch these videos, yeah, and there's so many distractions. You kind of get to lose your mind.
Yeah, Zoom was fun for like a week.
Hey, Zoom's been killing it in the stock market though, so I can't complain.
Yeah.
But so I guess I have, you know, kind of one more question for you.
Sure.
What are some things, you know, maybe related to COVID or outside of COVID, doesn't matter, that you're currently working on that kind of excites you, that you think could be a nice positive impact?
Okay. Well, yeah. So like last year, because of COVID, they asked us to pare down our bill schedule. I mean, our number of bills, which I complied with. Some people didn't, which, you know, I don't think it's fair. So I'm not even sure what I'm doing this year yet, because I want to see how this COVID surge, right, you know, transpires. But so there was a bill I did 2 years ago, got on the governor's desk, governor vetoed it, and said he would sign it the next time if I made it stronger. And so, and then I'm going to do that bill again. And what this bill does is, so California is the only state of the union that when it comes to dog plasma, which, you know, dog blood, mm-hmm, is they have closed colonies. So basically there's two private companies that house dogs in cages in warehouses, and they're in those cages for like 23 hours a day.
What?
Every day. And then every 10 to 14 days, they come in and they get their blood drawn. And we don't have enough blood. This issue came to me because I had a friend, her dog was sick. She's at the vet. He needs a blood transfusion. There's not enough blood there. And they're calling all over. And then they find out that they find a place where there's going to be enough blood, but it's 20 miles away. So she, you know, they throw the dog in the car and they're driving frantically to the next city, and the dog dies on the drive over. So then I learned about it, and like, yeah, it's like, this is outrageous. So my bill that was on the governor's desk that he vetoed adopted what other states do, which is basically, it's like we do as people, right? We leave our homes, we go to the Red Cross or wherever, we give blood, and then we go home. So it's a community-based model. Pet owners don't get paid for the blood. You know, they volunteer do it, but they do it everywhere, every other place in America, with the exception of California, and they've got plenty of blood, and it's just a more humane way to treat animals.
Yeah.
So my original bill allowed for community-based blood banks. It did not require shutting down the closed colonies. Yeah, because I believe that was going to happen just naturally. Because I believe I believe in the market, and I just think that it would close down anyway. He vetoed it because he wants the closed colonies closed. So I had a bill last year, got out of the Senate, and then they never heard it in the Assembly. So I'm going to do that bill this year, definitely, because I feel really strongly about it. Another bill I'm doing is allow California to grow industrial hemp. I actually did that bill 3 years ago to bring California in compliance with the federal law. And, you know, the thing about hemp is that America, because of the stigma, is way behind, you know, the rest of the world. And, you know, not only is it used for, you know, CBD and medicinal purposes, but, you know, they've learned how to pelletize it. So anything that you can make with plastic, which is carbon-based, you can now make with hemp. So a lot of auto parts in European cars, BMW, Mercedes, VW, is made out of hemp. And then the other thing they're doing in Europe, they're not using concrete anymore. They're using hempcrete. So it's a mixture that's made of hemp. It's cheaper than concrete. It's stronger than concrete. And it also sequesters carbon. So we're way behind on that. So I did the original bill that put us in compliance, and we started growing hemp in California. And then we had to keep up with the feds. And then for whatever reason, the assembly would not hear my bill at the end of last session. So we're out of compliance with the federal law right now. So I'm going to do that with an urgency clause. So the minute the governor signs it, it takes effect 30 days
That sounds like a later. No-brainer.
Yeah, I don't, you know, at the end of session, the fight's not between Republicans and Democrats. It's between the assembly and the Senate leadership. And a lot of bills get killed because they get in a fight with each other and they just don't move it. So I was just in the crossfire of what was going on. And then a bill I'm doing, it's actually a constitutional amendment. I don't expect it to pass, but we have to change the way we tax, and we have to change the way we spend money. In terms of how we tax, it's just way too volatile. But I don't have the bandwidth to do that. That's really something the governor has to do with all the stakeholders in the room. But I want to change the way that we spend money. So how we do it in this state is we have a budget process, and I'm not going to go into it, but it completely lacks transparency. The Sunlight Foundation, which is a nonpartisan nonprofit organization set up to monitor state budgets, gives California D minus for our transparency and accountability. So I want to shift to what 19 other states have, which is a 2-year budget process. So 1 year we would do budget. Next year we would do policy. Now in the years we do budget, we take a quarter of that budget and we do what's called performance-based budgeting. So the bureaucrats would have to come in and justify every single program. Because what we do in government, we look at input, but we never look at output, right? So case example, federal government, you know, LBJ's war on poverty, you know, 1964. We're gonna, you know, war on poverty. Sounds great. Since 1964, we have spent $15 trillion and our poverty rates are higher today than it was in 1964. So clearly the goal was good, but we've not achieved that, you know, the proper outcome. And that happens in a lot of programs. And I feel like we have enough money in California, we're just not properly spending it. And, you know, under the Constitution, we as a legislature, we have the responsibility to have oversight over these agencies and over the budget process. And I really feel like we don't fulfill those constitutional mandates. And I think we'd have a better and more accountable government if we did. So yeah, it's a constitutional amendment. So it's going to require 2/3 vote. I'm sure I'll get shot down in the first committee, but I just want to start talking about it because we've got to change the way we do this. Because, like, you know, in after the COVID thing hit in May, you know, Governor Newsom said we're going to have a $59 billion budget deficit. Now, I knew that wasn't – he was just kind of gaming it. But, you know, even the Legislative Analyst Office, which is like – that's like the state version of the CBO on the federal level, they're projecting about an $18 billion deficit, right, based upon, you know, figuring out where we're going to be in the economy. Well, guess what? The LAO just came out and they're now projecting a $26 billion surplus. And even Governor Newsom is predicting a $15 billion surplus. It'll be closer to 26 than it is to 15. And so it's really volatile. So we just got to fix this. And then, you know, and so we can reprioritize. I mean, we underfund K-12, we underfund higher ed, we underfund, you know, roads and infrastructure, and we spend way too much money on just dumb stuff. And I just feel like we got to rein this in and get it under control.
Right. But being in the minority party, it's, you don't think that's going to be able to gain too much, or you're just hoping it gains traction
for future conversations? I got 4 years left and do that. Yeah, I do most of my stuff I do on a bipartisan. I mean, if you look at my stuff, it's bipartisan. This first year, I'm going to do it on my own and see who shoots at me, and then hopefully try to kind of build out a coalition from there. So I'm going to have four bites at the apple, and I just. When you leave here, you want to leave footprints. So,
right.
So we'll see.
Well, hopefully that gains some traction and it can get going. That sounds really exciting. Well, I really want to thank you for, you know, taking your time and talking to me. I really appreciate it. And
no, me too. And I'm glad that you're reaching out and, you know, educating young people. I mean, I like to go to talk to high school classes and college classes for that matter. Because, like in California, you know, we are mortgaging your guys' future. I mean, you know, these Sacramento politicians, they come home and they'll talk about, we're the fifth largest economy in the world. And California is. But that's not because of Sacramento. That's because California has some of the hardest and smartest working people in the world. But the fact of the matter is, under the Constitution, the state auditor has to conduct an audit of California every year, right? So she adds up the assets and adds up the liabilities. And our net worth as a state is negative $129 billion.
Oh, my goodness.
So somebody at some point is going to have to pay for that.
Right.
And so, you know, my goal is always to try to leave the, you know, leave state, when I leave state government, to be, have it be in better shape than when I was a young person with the same opportunities. And we have failed at that. We have failed at that, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, hopefully we can get some, you know, more people like you and in there and get more young people involved and get it turned around. But we'll see.
All right. Yeah. Love to end on a happy note like that.
Seriously. Well, thank you very much for taking the time.
Hey, thanks, Jacob. Happy holidays to you and your family.
Thank you. You as well.
All right. Take care.
You too.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Passion Talks. To stay up to date with Passion Talks news and updates, make sure to follow at Passion Talks Podcast on Instagram. If you are interested in being a guest on the show, send a direct message to my account and I will get back to you as soon as possible. Thank you for listening.